Public Health from Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health, where she also completed her postdoctoral research fellowship. With over 30 years of global health experience, she currently works for Future Generations, and she is the Peru Country Director and Senior Health Advisor. Previous work as a consultant to the World Bank, Inter-American Development Bank, UNICEF, and others as Health Advisor and Program Evaluator. And Laura is also the... Stand up, Laura. The awardee of the Mid-Career Award of the International Health Section. So please come and join us this evening at 6:30 to honor Laura, who's very, very, very well-deserved award, and other awardees. And did I embarrass you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well-deserved. So please join us in the award dinner tonight. It's free food and great people to meet. Okay? Here's Laura. Good.
Thank you to my dear friend Elvira, who we've worked together for several years, on the issue of aid effectiveness. And in fact, what I'm going to present now is in a book on case studies and aid effectiveness that Elvira is putting out. So I'm just putting in a plug for Elvira's new book. So what I want to talk to you about today is actually a case study in a country program that has developed a structural framework that is more susceptible to improved effectiveness of aid. So we've had some very nice presentations about situational analysis in the world, you know, globally on aid effectiveness, and some other, you know, global scale experiences. And this will be a looking from the bottom up and seeing what is the bottom up strategy that you can use. Relationships.
Okay.
So I want to start out with just reviewing the Paris Declaration, 4 points, the broad national ownership of development strategies. So what a country actually does is the most important, how it structures itself to be able to receive aid in a better way. Capacity building of national actors and institutions, a strong voice for civil society in governance, again, locally, and achieving the Millennium Development Goals. So a lot of what is relevant in aid effectiveness is what a country actually does to restructure itself so that it can better receive aid. So talking about Peru, you all know South America, population of actually 30 million, kind of the wrong number there. So in this presentation, I'd like to talk about primary health care in Peru before and after it restructured to a new form of that better receives aid with local health administration committees, community participation, referred to as CLAS, managing for results, key factors in financial and human resources management with local governance for better aid effectiveness and how that is achieved. And then building on that with NGO assistance coming in to build an enhanced model of decentralized primary health care with CLAS for even better aid effectiveness. Because what the country does goes halfway, but then with more technical assistance, take it the rest of the way to really be effective. So I want to show you, I'm sorry? Oh, you can't hear me, I'm sorry. And also, I'm sorry, I'm just getting over some laryngitis. My voice is a little rough. Okay, thank you. Is that better? Okay, talking. So primary health care before 1994 is what you see in a lot of countries. With you have a regional health directorate that responds to the central ministry of health. You might have territorial health units that manage more directly primary health care services. And then you have communities. And so what is the link here with communities? You have demand for services from the communities, and you have roles and functions that have been poorly defined of how the primary health care services actually are supposed to work in the communities. And so in 1994, there was the original CLAS Supreme Decree that created local health administration committees. These are private nonprofit civil associations under private law that were designed to work in collaboration with the government with representation and legalized involvement with communities, with six for each class. You would have six community members. You would have the manager of the class, who was the head of the health facility. who would manage it, and then you would have this committee, the board of directors, that would be conformed of community members and the doctor from the health facility, and they would make all the decisions on how to spend the money. They would receive the money from the government on the basis of a local health plan that would be designed with community members. There would be a shared administration, a shared administration contract signed between the president of the class, who's from the community, and the regional health office to agree on achieving the local health plan based on the budget. And there was a transfer of funds from public to private. So the class would have a private account that they would receive money into, and they would pay the doctors and by the facilities. So the class receives resources transferred from public and private sources, from the central public treasury, from ordinary resources for paying salaries, for goods and services, and also public insurance reimbursements would go to the class account. Also, local government, municipal funds from their budget, from participatory budgets, and also from international donor agencies could actually deposit money directly into the account and of the class. And in fact, they did. Not in all the class, but wherever they wanted to, they could do that. And then others. So the way the class was designed with a private, under private law, it was a mix of private and public law. They could receive all these donations and use them for their own purposes. So the class, with the community involvement, makes spending decisions with transparency and accountability. And this makes aid more effective. So the money going to the class would spend it on selecting, contracting, and supervising personnel, for prioritizing and planning their purchases and equipment, and also for building, contracting for building, and also for financing community-based health promotion. So we have a transfer of funds. The class is obligates itself to provide services, but overseeing the work of the health providers, and the class signs a contract to complete their local health plan. So this new model has brand new reform aspects in financial management and human resources management for primary health care that make it much more efficient. So in a non-class health facility, there's no mechanism for local financial management. You have fee for services that might be collected, have to be deposited into the Ministry of Health account. They can't use them locally. Public health insurance reimbursed actually doesn't get reimbursed to the facility. It gets reimbursed to a higher level, and then they do the purchases at a higher level. No contracting or purchasing can be affected. But in a class, completely different. You have a private bank account controlled by the class, transfer of public funds into the account. Fees for services could be kept by the class and deposited into their own account. Public insurance reimbursed into the class community accounts for management by the community. And most personnel salaries and purchases were paid for out of the class from their account. So you have local control of budgets under law. And in terms of human resource management, you have in the non-class, you have mainly government payroll employees who have basically no accountability to the community or to the government, short-term contracts with no benefits, evaluation based on reported consultations. And in a class, on the other hand, you also do have payroll employees, but they're accountable to the class committee. The community can come in and say, why aren't you working? Why aren't you on time? Why are you treating badly the patients? And they would have to respond to that because under law that happens. Private sector contracts with full benefits. So there's a new kind of contract out of the class with better benefits for health providers through the class. And they are accountable. So we have some data, and I'm just going to show a little bit of it. This is one showing how you can improve the equity through class versus non-class, class being the blue, where the lowest three quintiles, you can see very clearly that the class are more effective in providing the exoneration of fees because of the class committee in the community can identify who in the community needs to be exonerated, and they could tell the health service that person needs to not pay or can get a lower fee. And so they're more successful in providing services to the poor people. And also in terms of the average number of consultations per child, comparing class and non-class and urban and rural, it's very clear here that the class, both the rural, which is a darker color, the rural and the urban class, have far superior coverage of child health services than the non-class. And why is it? Well, there's different types of incentives for the health personnel to provide more quality services. They're more able to improve their infrastructure, to buy better equipment, to really improve the actual service provided in the class so that people are more likely to come. Whereas in the non-class, they are very poor services, the doctors treat them badly, and so they don't even go. So you have much better service. Okay, so in 2002, there was a decentralization. We have the same kind of model. So by 2002, one-third of all primary health care facilities in Peru have been under this model to this day. We have one-third. Okay. With decentralization, the regional health office was turned over to regional governments, not to the Ministry of Health. The municipality was assigned the responsibility of management of primary health care, but there was still poor function, no functions really well designed and defined, and also you continued with this problem of poor roles and functions defined from the government. So 2007, between 2003 and 2007, there was work on a law, so there was a new law put into place on this, where they expanded the participation in class. So now every community, not just six members of the community, but every community had two members on class. And there are more members from different areas. All the red lines are all the new members of the class. And there's more detail on accountability and operational management and accountability. And so with outside in technical assistance, these roles and functions to improve the quality of this co-management, we improve the quality and define these functions so that strengthening the health system to work better with the communities on the one side, and also better defining the roles of the municipality. And these blue green lines coming in are how all the different flows of money can go to a class now from the municipality, from outside, from the regional government to fund class, and also on the basis of community work plans coming up from the bottom, with the community actually defining what they need, then money can flow from the class to the community work plans and also from the municipality directly to communities. And this model has won a number of awards, in, including this year in Peru. Thank you very much.
Great. All the presenters have been great at managing time. So now I would like to welcome all the presenters to come to the table so we can have questions. And just to remind everybody, Dr. Gloy talked about his reflections on the role of NGOs and how we can be better and more transparent and being more effective. And then Dr. Zion showed the importance of transparency of NGOs, how you can be accountable for the impact that you make, how one organization can really account and really measure the impact that they make. I also want to emphasize the importance of really reforming what we do, because we've been doing it for many years, like food aid. It doesn't mean that we are more efficient. We have to always strive and call your representatives. The role of private sector, as Dr. Negrete posed, and then the model that we have in Peru that maybe should be adapted to other countries about having local governance, having local control, having many eyes watching the public funds and accountability. So, questions? Yes, please. Would you please stand up, say your name loudly, and...
Hi, Sally! Buying up commodity crops and
Sure. So it's very complex, right? So if you have another buyer on the market, there may be changes in the price of commodities. So far, the U.S.'s program has been fairly small, but I think that that's something that that the United States has to be very cognizant of. I don't have data off of the top of my head from other countries, but I don't think that I think all aid countries are quite aware of that and try to mitigate that whenever possible. But yeah, it's a good question.
Thank you. Another question, please. The question is about distribution in conflict-afflicted countries. So it gets recorded, that's why.
All right. Yes, we do. I mean, we have actually two programs. One is emergency response, and the other one is post-conflict reconstruction. And in both programs, we have partners we are working with on the ground. So every time there is an incident, we identify the local partners who is working, and we work through them to ship the product.
Good. Thank you. A question over there. Yes, sir. Go ahead. So about the question is about local and international NGOs, maybe. By the way, this is Stephen Lloyd. Donna Barry couldn't join us today, so.
Okay.
Just as handsome as Donna.
I'm not sure of that. Donna's special. What I was referring to were primarily the 501c3s, the international NGOs, who, of course, work on behalf of governments, but they're quite separate. The local NGOs were pretty much outside of the discussion, except for the fact that there has been a movement in the last probably 10, 15 years to increase the amount of donor funding that somehow gets to local NGOs. But typically, local NGOs don't have the capacity to be able to actually access those funds themselves because they're too small, so there's been an effort to get money to local NGOs via those INGOs, the big international agencies. And that's happening a lot. PEPFAR, in fact, has recognized the situation of weak governments and strong INGOs, the big NGOs, and they have adopted a program that's called the Transition Program. The idea being that, you know, the big NGOs aren't going to be around a lot. AIDS treatment is going to be really hard for them to perpetuate after 5-10 years. So after the first 5 years of funding, the track one big NGOs were given an additional 5 years of transition funding to be able to transition to funding these local NGOs, okay? The only problem is that just like any entity, you know, your desire is to perpetuate yourself. So in the case of at least two and probably all four of the main entities, the big NGOs that save the, or excuse me, ICAP, Columbia's group, EGPAF, Catholic Relief Services, at least those three, essentially created kind of mini-me organizations. In the case of EGPAF, they created an organization called Ariel, which is the same people, for the most part, who used to work for EGPAF are now working for these Ariel entities that are pretty similar in all countries, and they really function just like an INGO, quite big, and it's hard to know how sustainable they're going to be in the future. So we're really referring to these large organizations, even though there are local forms of these large organizations that have recently been formed.
Thank you. Yeah, one wonders how companies adapt to survive, and sometimes whether you should try to look at your mission as an organization and maybe think of doing something different and not just trying to replicate yourself. So I think you have a question, sir? No? Yes, ma'am, in the back. Yeah. Hi, Rachel. Go ahead. I just want to say that we don't have evaluations yet, and we don't have data to demonstrate, but yes, it's very innovative. You'd like to?
Yeah, I just would like to say that my organization, I would say over 90% of its budget comes from private sources. And although we are trying hard really to do like big NGOs, you know, of course our impact is fairly small, you know, and the institution we are dealing with are limited. And it is a struggle because communicating a message, a complex message of building local capacity for a private donor who have an attention span of few seconds becomes extremely difficult really to pay off, you know, for.
Yes, Laura, go ahead.
In the case of Kiva and other similar types of things, those are more directly funding small groups, small community groups, or even people to do work locally. So, and I think that the aid effectiveness really, I mean, that whole concept really has to be strengthening a government program. In order to receive aid and pass it down to the community level so that you have more sustainability, you have a whole strengthened system so that on an ongoing basis you have a more sustained development at the local level. And Kiva would be kind of like a spotty thing and not, it's
to have impact. Yeah.
Yeah, to really have impact on a long term, it would be a different type of model. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. One more question. Yes, sir.
My name is Taylor Williams. I work for RTI International. I've worked for one of these large international NGOs and have my entire career. And so it's always interesting to hear an indictment of, you know, the entire industry in which I spent my career. But I'm curious what you think about the shift within USAID now toward more implementation letters with AIDS commissions, with ministries of health, the move in Rwanda toward more on-budget support, not really budget support, but alignment with government policies and structures. It seems like it's a bit of fits and starts, but it's more in the right direction. So I want to hear your thoughts on that kind of movement.
Well, thanks for your first comment about the indictment. As I think I said, I've been doing the same thing as you for all these years, and I'm indicting essentially my own industry. So, you know, that's my transparency. Yes, I do think that there's certainly an increasing realization that this is a problem and that we need to do more direct governmental support. I mean, the fact is, and I was really intrigued by CLASS, because CLASS seemed like a really interesting approach. It is still government support, it's just government support at a different level, and it takes a long time to create some of these agencies with enough administrative management capacity to be able to do the kinds of things that are necessary. And, you know, for so many years, because of this kind of almost knee-jerk, you know, anti-governmental or anti-public sector sort of sense, particularly from the Ronald Reagan, you know, into this administration, it's been really hard to convince aid to do what they're doing in Rwanda now, which is actually contributing to the government. And one of the reasons that that's happening in Rwanda is that Rwanda does have, in fact, a fairly strong government. They do have a pretty good, strong tax base. And most countries in sub-Saharan Africa aren't like Rwanda and don't have the power. Plus, the RTIs, the HAIs, the, you know, the big NGO organizations are incredibly well organized, and they want to make sure that there are financial flows that continue in their direction. So my sense is that this is a really important time where there's a realization, as you've said, that you really, you know, the poor aren't going to be able to, you know, who earn less than a dollar a day aren't going to be able to pay for their own, you know, health care very well. And governments need to provide at least some sort of a network of care. And the Europeans are pretty much there, sort of understanding that this is necessary, and the Americans are moving in that direction. I think if more of us in your situation and in my situation actually sort of talk about what we see on a day-to-day basis, whether it's the per diem issues or the issues of the high salaries or the disparities and the passive-aggressive, you know, resentment activities that occur all the time. If we talk about those kinds of things, if we actually are testaments to the distortions of an industry that is incredibly well-meaning, I think it's going to move towards the kinds of changes you're talking about.
Yeah, thanks. That's right. Thank you. Good. One more question. Yeah, go ahead.
My name is Laura Durana, and I wanted to...
Hi, Laura.
That's
right. Charity. Yeah, that's how our business originated, through charity. So that legacy is still there. We need to move on. Want to come to the? Can you come to the microphone so everybody can hear you?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Under the new law, there are in each class there would be two representatives from each community in the jurisdiction of a health facility. So that would maybe you would have 10 or 20 communities. So each community would select their own two representatives, that would be a community leader and a health worker, community health worker. And then you might have some community-based organizations, and each one, their president gets to be on the General Assembly of this. And then from the public sector, you have one health provider is elected among, all the health providers select one of their own to be a representative, and the local government municipality has his own representative, cannot be the mayor. And then the regional government also has somebody. So there's this large body that's called the General Assembly. And then according to the law and the regulations, out of those people, which could be up to 50 people, depending on how many communities you have, then they, among themselves, select who's on the board of directors. And there has to be four people from the community and the other three from the government entities. And so it's very structured about who's represented. And under the new law, it's much more democratic selection. So, you know, it's a very democratic representation of everyone who's on the class. And the other question, the other part of that question was? Also in the law, it's very specific about what are the roles of the manager, the roles of the president of the class, the treasurer of the class, and how they can be held accountable legally. for management or mismanagement of funds. They have to report monthly on their financial, their expenses to the regional government, et cetera. It's very detailed. And the new law from 2007 takes into account all the lessons learned from the previous 18 years of ongoing work in the field, and put it in there to make sure that they're to stop all the little problems and issues that come up constantly. So
great.
The new law is good.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. That program is very well documented, and it can really be adapted by others. We have time for one last question. Who wants to, and then we can open the, yes, ma'am.
I'm living in the older, originally from Liberia.
Liberia, oh good.
I'm just wondering, with the ineffectiveness of aid, my main concern is that most of the aid is not reaching down to the country.
Right. You come to APHA and speak about them, and then talk to your representative, and it's very important, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This I'd like you to be on next year's panel. Very good, thank you. Let's give all our presenters a big hand.